to outdistance or outpace them. He even offered an impassioned rationale. Can't you see how much better it is for us to associate ourselves with concepts like goal and outdistance than target and beat? In truth, I couldn't. I was skeptical that such small wording shifts would affect the thinking and conduct of individuals within the SSM system in any meaningful fashion. But that was then. I'm a convert now. My response to SSM's strict language policy transformed from, "Geez, this is silly," to, "Geez, this is smart." The conversion occurred after I undertook a concentrated review of an astounding body of research findings. Incidental, but not accidental, exposure to words. He who wants to persuade should put his trust not in the right argument, but in the right word. Joseph Conrad. Staying within the realm of violent language for the moment, consider the results of an experiment that exposed people to hostile words and then measured their subsequent aggressiveness. In the study, subjects completed a task requiring them to arrange 30 sets of scrambled words to make coherent sentences. For half of the subjects, when the words they were given were arranged correctly, they resulted mostly in sentences associated with aggression. For example, "hit he them" became "he hit them." For the other half of the subjects, when the words they were given were arranged correctly, they resulted mostly in sentences with no connections to aggression. For example, "door the fix" became "fix the door." Later, all the subjects participated in another task in which they had to deliver 20 electric shocks to a fellow subject and got to decide how painful the required shocks would be. The results are alarming. Prior exposure to the violence-linked words led to a 48% jump in selected shock intensity. In light of such findings, nonviolent language requirements make perfect sense for SSM. As a healthcare organization, it should operate within the bounds of the fundamental principle of medical ethics. Above all, do no harm. But note that, as a high-performance healthcare organization, SSM did not prohibit the use of achievement-related words. Instead, it replaced such words possessing menacing associations, target, beat, with comparable words that did not, goal, outdistance. Perhaps this practice reveals the belief of SSM's leadership that, just as violence-laden language could lead to elevated harm-doing and therefore should be eliminated, achievement-laden language could lead to elevated performance and therefore should be retained. If SSM leaders do hold that belief, they'd be right. Multiple studies have shown that subtly exposing individuals to words that connote achievement, win, attain, succeed, master, increases their performance on an assigned task and more than doubles their willingness to keep working at it. Evidence like this has changed my mind about the worth of certain kinds of posters that I've occasionally seen adorning the walls of business offices. Call centers appear to be a favorite location. The signs usually carry a single word in capital letters: overcome, succeed, persevere, achieve, designed to spur employees toward greater accomplishments. Sometimes the word is presented alone. Sometimes it's accompanied by a related image, such as a runner winning a race. Sometimes just the image is presented. In any of their forms, I'd always thought it only laughably likely that signs of this sort would work. But once again, this time thanks to some Canadian researchers, that was then. I've since become aware of a project those researchers undertook to influence the productivity of fundraisers who operated out of a call center. At the start of callers' work shifts, all were given information designed to help them communicate the value of contributing to the cause for which they were soliciting, a local university. Some of the callers got the information printed on plain paper. Other callers got the identical information printed on paper carrying a photo of a runner winning a race. It was a photo that had previously been shown to stir achievement-related thinking. Remarkably, by the end of their 3-hour shifts, the second sample of callers had raised 60% more money than their otherwise comparable co-workers. It appears, then, that initial incidental exposure either to simple words or simple images can have a persuasive impact on later actions that are merely associated with the words or images. Let's explore some influence-related implications, beginning with words of a special kind.
Metaphor is a metador, to change. If you want to change the world, change the metaphor. Joseph Campbell. Since Aristotle's Poetics, circa 350 BCE, communicators have been advised to use metaphor to get their points across. They've been told that an effective way to convey a somewhat elusive concept to an audience is to describe it in terms of another concept that the audience can recognize readily. Long-distance runners, for instance, recount the experience of being unable to continue a race as hitting the wall. Of course, there is no real wall involved, but certain characteristics of a physical barrier, it blocks further passage, it can't be dispatched easily, it can't be denied, have enough in common with the runner's bodily sensations that the label delivers useful meaning. Yet the use of metaphor has its critics, complaining that it is often misleading. They point out that when one thing, such as the inability to take another step in a race, is understood in terms of another, like a wall, some genuine overlap between the two might be revealed, but the correspondence is usually far from perfect. For instance, a physical wall normally owes its presence to the actions of someone other than the person who hits it, whereas a runner's wall normally owes its presence to the actions of the runner, whose training, or lack thereof, and race pacing led to the problem. So runners employing the wall metaphor might be doing more than choosing a frame designed to communicate the feeling of motoric collapse. For strategic purposes, they might be choosing a frame designed to depict the failing as external to them, as not of their doing, and thus not their fault. Recall that new psycholinguistic analysis suggests that the main function of language is not to express or describe, but to influence, something it does by channeling recipients to sectors of reality preloaded with a set of mental associations favorable to the communicator's view. If so, we can see why metaphor, which directs people to think of one thing in terms of their associations to a selected other thing, possesses great potential as a linguistic device. Indeed, for well over a half century, researchers have been documenting the superior impact of metaphor, applied properly. More recently, though, emphasis on the transfer of associations inherent in metaphor has generated an eye-opening array of persuasive effects. Suppose, for instance, that you are a political consultant who has been hired by a candidate for mayor of a nearby city to help her win an election in which a recent surge in crime is an important issue. In addition, suppose that this candidate and her party are known for their tough stance on crime that favors policies designed to capture and incarcerate lawbreakers. The candidate wants your counsel on what she could do to make voters believe that her approach to the problem is correct. With an understanding of the workings of metaphoric persuasion, your advice could be swift and confident. In any public pronouncements on the topic, she should portray the crime surge as a wild beast rampaging through the city that must be stopped. Why? Because to bring a wild beast under control, it's necessary to catch and cage it. In the minds of her audiences, these natural associations to the proper handling of rampaging animals will transfer to the proper handling of crime and criminals. Now imagine instead that the candidate and her party are known for a different approach to the problem, one that seeks to halt the growth of crime by treating its societal causes, such as joblessness, lack of education, and poverty. In this instance, still on the basis of an understanding of metaphoric persuasion, your advice could also be swift and confident. In all her public pronouncements on the topic, the candidate should portray the crime surge as a spreading virus infecting the city that must be stopped. Why? Because to bring a virus under control, it's necessary to remove the unhealthy conditions that allow it to breed and spread. These disease-related associations should now frame the way citizens think about how best to deal with their crime problem. If other advisors within the candidate's campaign scoff at the metaphor-based rationale for your plan, calling it simplistic, you might ask them to consider some relevant data. Stanford University researchers exposed a randomly chosen set of online readers to a news account of a 3-year rise in city crime rates that depicted crime as a ravaging beast. Other randomly chosen readers saw the same news account and statistics, except for one word. The criminality was depicted as a ravaging virus. Later, the survey asked them all to indicate their preferred solutions. In the most precise analysis of the results, readers who initially saw crime portrayed as a beast recommended catch-and-cage solutions rather than remove unhealthy condition solutions. But the opposite pattern emerged among readers who initially saw crime portrayed as a virus. Remarkably, the size of the difference due to the change of a single word, 22%, was more than double the size of preferred solution differences that were naturally due to the reader's gender, 9%, or political party affiliation, 8%. When predicting voter preferences, political campaigns include the role of demographic factors such as gender and party affiliation. Rarely, though, do they consider the potentially greater predictive power of a persuasively deployed metaphor. If the mayor's other advisors are of the sort that dismisses findings from controlled scientific research as irrelevant to real-world settings, you could offer them a form of evidence from the real world. Maximally effective salespeople understand the power of metaphor. You might ask the advisors to consider the case of high school dropout Ben Feldman, who, despite never doing business outside a 60-mile radius of his little hometown of East Liverpool, Ohio, became the greatest life insurance salesman of his time, and perhaps of all time. Indeed, at his peak, in the 1970s and 1980s, he sold more life insurance by himself than 1,500 of the 1,800 insurance agencies in the United States. In 1992, after he had been admitted to a hospital because of a cerebral hemorrhage, his employer, New York Life, decided to honor the great salesman's 50 years with the company by declaring Feldman February, a month in which all its agents would compete to get the largest total in new sales. Who won? Ben Feldman. How? By calling prospects from his hospital bed, where the 80-year-old closed $15 million in new contracts in 28 days. That kind of relentless drive and commitment to the job accounts for some but not all of the man's phenomenal success. According to chroniclers of that success, he never pressured reluctant prospects into a sale. Instead, he employed a light and enlightened touch that led them smoothly toward a purchase. Mr. Feldman was a master of metaphor. In his portrayal of life's end, for instance, people didn't die, they walked out of life. A characterization that benefited from associations to a breach in one's family responsibilities that would need to be filled. He was then quick to depict life insurance as the metaphorically aligned solution. When you walk out, he would say, your insurance money walks in. When exposed to this metaphoric lesson in the moral responsibility of buying life insurance, many a customer straightened up and walked right. Although metaphors require a language-based link between two things to work, once that link is in place, metaphoric persuasion can be triggered non-verbally. For instance, in English and many other languages, the concept of weight, heaviness, is linked metaphorically to the concepts of seriousness, importance, and effort. For that reason, 1, raters reading a job candidate's qualifications attached to a heavy versus light clipboard come to see the applicant as a more serious contender for the job. 2. Raters reading a report attached to a heavy clipboard come to see the topic as more important. And 3. Raters holding a heavy object, requiring more effort of them, put more effort into considering the pros and cons of an improvement project for their city. This set of findings raises the specter that manufacturers' drive to make e-readers as light as possible will lessen the seeming value of the presented material, the perceived intellectual depth of its author, and the amount of energy readers will be willing to devote to its comprehension. Comparable findings have appeared in studies of another arena of human judgment, personal warmth, where individuals who have held a warm object briefly, for example, a cup of hot versus iced coffee, immediately feel warmer toward, closer to, and more trusting of those around them. Hence, they become more giving and cooperative in the social interactions that follow shortly afterward. It's evident, then, that powerful metaphoric associations can be persuasively activated without a word. Touch is enough. More hot stuff. Because negative associations can be transferred as easily as positive ones, spontaneously shared meaning can be as much a nightmare as a dream for communicators. A few years ago, a white government official received so much criticism that he resigned his position after using the word niggardly to describe how he planned to handle his office's tight budget. The word means miserly or reluctant to spend, but plainly another family of associations provoked the negative reaction. For a fundamentally related reason, used car salespeople are taught not to describe their cars as used, which links to notions of wear and tear, but to say pre-owned, which bridges to thoughts of possession and ownership. Similarly, information technology providers are counseled against telling customers the cost or price of their offerings, which are terms associated with the loss of resources. Rather, they are to speak of the purchase or investment amount involved, terms that make contact with the concept of gain. The pilot and flight attendant training programs of some commercial airlines now include hints on how to avoid death-related language when communicating to passengers before or during a flight. The scary-sounding "your final destination" is to be trimmed to "your destination," and "terminal" is to be replaced with "gate" whenever possible. It goes without saying that savvy marketers not only want to avoid coupling their products and services to elements with negative associations, they want to play both defense and offense by eliminating connections to factors that carry the most unfavorable connotations while maximizing connections to those with the most favorable ones. What are those most intensely evaluated elements? There is much to say in Chapter 13 about the concept that people respond to with the greatest passion on the negative side of the ledger, so its coverage will be deferred until then. But to reduce any resulting Zeigarnik effect tensions, a brief advance notice is in order. The concept preloaded with associations most damaging to immediate assessments and future dealings is untrustworthiness, along with its concomitants, such as lying and cheating. Our hotties, ourselves. On the upside of things, though, the factor with the most favorable impact in the realm of human evaluation is one we have encountered before, the self, which gains its power from a pair of sources. Not only does it draw and hold our attention with nearly electromagnetic strength, thereby enhancing perceived importance, it also brings that attention to an entity that the great majority of us shower with positive associations. Therefore, anything that is self-connected or can be made to seem self-connected gets an immediate lift in our eyes. Sometimes the connections can be trivial, but can still serve as springboards to persuasive success. People who learn that they have a birthday, birthplace, or first name in common come to like each other more, which leads to heightened cooperativeness and helpfulness toward each other. Potential customers are more willing to enroll in an exercise program if told they have the same date of birth as the personal trainer who will be providing the service. Learning of such connections online offers no immunity. Young women are twice as likely to friend a man who contacts them on Facebook if he claims to have the same birthday. The small business loans to citizens of developing nations brokered through a microfinance website are significantly more likely to be offered by loan providers to recipients whose names share their initials. Finally, researchers studying this general tendency to value entities linked to the self, called implicit egoism, have found that individuals prefer not just people but also commercial products, crackers, chocolates, and teas, with names that share letters of the alphabet with their own names. To take advantage of this affinity, in the summer of 2013, the British division of Coca-Cola replaced its own package branding with one or another of 150 of the most common first names in the United Kingdom, doing so on 100 million packs of their product. What could justify the expense? Similar programs in Australia and New Zealand had boosted sales significantly in those regions the year before. When finally tried in the United States, it produced the first increase in Coke sales in a decade. Even organizations can be susceptible to the tendency to overvalue things that include elements of their names. In 2004, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of rock and roll, Rolling Stone magazine issued a list of the 500 greatest songs of the rock era. The two highest-rated songs, as compiled and weighted by Rolling Stone editors, were Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan and I Can't Get No Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones. At the time of this writing, I checked 10 comparable lists of the greatest rock and roll songs, and none listed either of Rolling Stone's picks as its number one or number two choice. I am we, and we are number one. When considering the persuasive implications of implicit egoism, there's an important qualification to be taken into account. The overvalued self isn't always the personal self. It can also be the social self, the one framed not by the characteristics of the individual, but by the characteristics of that individual's group. The conception of self as residing outside the individual and within a related social unit is particularly strong in some non-Western societies whose citizens have a special affinity for things that appear connected to a collectively constructed self. An analysis of 2 years of magazine ads in the United States and South Korea found that, 1. In South Korea, the ads attempted to link products and services mostly to the reader's family or group, whereas in America, it was mostly to the individual reader. And 2, in terms of measured impact, group-linked ads were more effective in South Korea, while ads linked to the individual were more effective in the United States. The recognition of what Eastern world audiences value furnished South Korea's government with a wise negotiating tactic to use in dealing with Afghan militants. It was a tactic that, although simple, had been almost absent from the approach of Western negotiators in Afghanistan up to that point, and is still underused there by Western powers. In July 2007, the Afghan Taliban kidnapped 21 South Korean church-sponsored aid workers, holding them hostage and killing two as a savage initial show of will. Talks designed to free the remaining 19 went so badly that the kidnappers named the next two hostages they planned to murder, prompting the head of the South Korean National Intelligence Service, Kim Man-bok, to fly in to try to salvage the negotiations. He brought a plan. It was to connect the South Korean bargaining team to something central to the group identity of the militants, their language. Upon his arrival, Kim replaced his head negotiator, whose appeals had been transmitted through an Afghan translator, with a South Korean representative who spoke fluent Pashtun. According to Kim, who won the hostages' swift release, the key in the negotiations was language. However, it was not because of any greater precision or lucidity of the verbal exchanges involved, but because of something more primitive and persuasive. When our counterparts saw that our negotiator was speaking their language, Pashtun, they developed a kind of strong intimacy with us, and so the talks went well. Easy does it. Besides the self, there is another concept possessed of decidedly positive associations worth examining, because of how communicators can fumble the opportunity to harness those associations effectively. It is easy. There is much positivity associated with getting something with ease, but in a particular way. When we grasp something fluently, that is, we can picture or process it quickly and effortlessly, we not only like that thing more, but also think it is more valid and worthwhile. For this reason, poetry possessing rhyme and regular meter evokes something more than greater favor from readers. It also evokes perceptions of higher aesthetic value, the opposite of what the proponents of free verse and the gatekeepers of modern poetry journals appear to believe. Researchers in the field of cognitive poetics have even found that the fluency-producing properties of rhyme lead to enhanced persuasion. The statement, "Caution and measure will win you riches," is seen as more true when changed to, "Caution and measure win you treasure." There's a mini-lesson here for persuasive success. To make it climb, make it rhyme. Within the domain of general attraction, observers have a greater liking for those whose facial features are easy to recognize and whose names are easy to pronounce. Tellingly, when people can process something with cognitive ease, they experience increased neuronal activity in the muscles of their face that produce a smile. On the flip side, if it's difficult to process something, observers tend to dislike that experience and, accordingly, that thing. The consequences can be striking. An analysis of the names of 500 attorneys at 10 U.S. law firms found that the harder an attorney's name was to pronounce, the lower he or she stayed in the firm's hierarchy. This effect held, by the way, independent of the foreignness of the names. A person with a difficult-to-pronounce foreign name would likely be in an inferior position to one with an easy-to-pronounce foreign name. A similar effect occurs when observers encounter hard-to-pronounce drugs or food additives. They become less favorable toward the products and their potential risks. So why do nutritional supplement and pharmaceutical companies give their products names that are difficult to pronounce and spell, such as Zeljans and Farxiga? Maybe they are trying to communicate the family of plants or chemicals the product comes from. If so, it seems a poor trade-off. A lack of fluency in business communication can be problematic in additional ways. I can't count the number of times I've sat at restaurant tables struggling to read extended descriptions of menu items presented in almost illegible, flourish-filled fonts or in inadequate light, or both. You would think that restaurateurs, hoping to tempt us, would know better, as research has revealed that the food detailed in difficult-to-process descriptions is seen as less tempting, and that difficult-to-read claims are, in general, seen as less true. But perhaps the most damaging failure of business professionals to heed these effects occurs within stock exchanges. One analysis of 89 randomly selected companies that began trading shares on the New York Stock Exchange between 1990 and 2004 found that although the effect dwindled over time, those companies with easier-to-pronounce names outperformed those with difficult-to-pronounce names. A comparable analysis of easy-to-pronounce three-letter stock ticker codes, such as KAR, versus difficult-to-pronounce codes, such as RDO, on the American Stock Exchange, produced comparable results. If it seems from this evidence that we are relegated to a discomforting pawn-like status in many ordinary situations, much of the research covered so far in this book indicates that there is good reason for the concern. Must we resign ourselves then to being moved around haphazardly on the chessboard of life by the associations to whatever words, symbols, or images we happen to encounter? Fortunately, no. Provided that we understand how associative processes work, we can exert strategic, persuasive control over them. First, we can choose to enter situations that possess the set of associations we want to experience. When we don't have such available choices, we can front-load impending situations with cues carrying associations that will send us in personally gainful directions. We consider how next. Chapter 8. Persuasive Geographies. All the Right Places, All the Right Traces. There is a geography of influence. When I began writing my first book for a general audience, I was on a leave of absence at a university other than my own. Because my campus office was located on an upper floor, it was possible to arrange my desk so that as I wrote, I could look out the window at an array of imposing buildings housing various academic institutes, centers, and departments. On either border of this outside window to the academic world, I'd line shelves with materials that provided an inside window to that world. My professional books, journals, articles, and files. In town, I'd leased an apartment and would try to write at a desk there, which I'd also positioned in front of a window. Although I didn't intend it, that home location offered a view unlike the one outside my university office. Instead of rigid strongholds of scholarly industry, I'd see the flow of passers-by, mostly pedestrians on their way to work or to shop or to do any of a thousand ordinary things that people ordinarily do. The environment around my desk was importantly different, too, especially the information environment. Newspapers, magazines, tabletops, and television shows took the place of scientific publications, textbooks, filing cabinets, and conversations with colleagues. Writing in those separate places produced an effect I didn't anticipate and didn't even notice until about a month into the process, when I gathered all of the book project's preliminary pages and read them as a piece. The work I'd done at home was miles better than what I'd done at the university, because it was decidedly more appropriate for the general audience I'd envisioned. Indeed, in style and structure, the output from my campus desk was poorly suited to anyone but professional colleagues. Surprised, I wondered how it could be that despite a clear grasp of my desired market, I couldn't write for it properly while in my university office. Only in retrospect was the answer obvious. Any time I lifted or turned my head, the sight lines from my on-campus desk brought me into contact with cues linked to an academic approach and its specialized vocabulary, grammar, and style of communication. It didn't matter what I knew, somewhere in my head, about the traits and preferences of my intended readers. There were few cues in that environment to spur me to think routinely and automatically of those individuals as I wrote. From my desk at home, though, the cues were matched to the task. There, surrounded by prompted associations to the people I wanted to write for all along, I could harmonize with them much more successfully. With this guiding realization, I took all the pages I'd written at the university and, making a persuasive geography-based decision, revised them at home. It was a worthwhile undertaking. Take as proof that the book's initial opening line, "My academic subdiscipline, experimental social psychology, has as a principal domain the study of the social influence process," changed mercifully to, "I can admit it freely now, all my life I've been a patsy." Knowing what to do next wasn't difficult. toil on the book was routed home, while I consigned colleague-targeted work to my university office. Certain lessons from this experience extend beyond crafting popular scholarship. They apply to the much broader question of how any of us might arrange our physical environments persuasively to send us down selected associative pathways, chutes, toward desired ends. Several consultancy firms develop for corporate clients systems designed to stimulate employees to work more effectively, mostly through incentive programs that reward them for reaching performance goals. While talking to a project manager from one of these firms at a marketing conference, I raised a question I regularly pose to experienced practitioners regarding what makes them successful in their fields. In her case, I asked what she had found that allowed her to forge the most successful incentive programs. After listing several factors whose positive impact she could easily understand, extent of experience of her team in the client's industry, level of information the client's team provided to hers, amount of preparation on the part of both teams, she mentioned one she didn't understand at all. There was a type of working space at client headquarters that lent itself to crafting programs that had later turned out particularly well. Centrally located rooms with glass walls. She told me she'd noticed this odd outcome because she'd expected the opposite, thinking that the sight of all manner of employees swirling around and by would pull the attention of the room's program planners away from relevant task considerations and toward irrelevant ones. "Wouldn't you have thought the same thing?" she asked. I related my two writing desks story, explaining that my answer once would have been yes, but not since that important learning experience. In its aftermath, I now thought she was treating as irrelevant certain aspects of the work environment that had been highly related to task success. To do the best job of developing employee incentive programs, I suspected that she and her team needed ongoing visual exposure to employees who would be covered by the programs. It had been true for me. I needed present reminders of my prospective audience members to keep my writing aligned with their interests and communication styles. That was why I decided to write my book exclusively in the space that provided those reminders. Although persuaded by my account, the lady was not pleased by it. She claimed, rightly, that the ability to choose an ideal production environment didn't apply to her as it had to me. Her team had never been in a position to control which working space it would get at client headquarters. That was always the client's prerogative. Besides, she complained, most of these buildings don't even have a glass-walled conference room. So just knowing why those rooms work out well doesn't really help me. I could understand her frustration. For most people, recognizing how the influence process functions in a particular situation isn't sufficient. They also want to know how to harness the recognition. She left our conversation disappointed, but not defeated, it turned out. Months later, she called in an upbeat mood to tell me about the great success of a new quality enhancement tactic she had been trying. It emerged during a discussion with her staffers when she'd mentioned my claim that getting visual access to a client's employees while developing programs for them could improve the process. Her team's challenge then became finding a way to give themselves continuous low-level exposure to those employees, even when operating in a closed-up conference room. The youngest of her staff hit on a solution that was easy to implement and has since proven effective. Before traveling to any working meeting, the team now downloads photos of program-eligible employees from the client's website and internal publications. They then enlarge the pictures, put them on big poster boards, and lean them against the walls in whichever conference room they work.
The clients reportedly love the idea because they appreciate the personalized touch the consultants bring to the job. Notice that because the manager and her team structure the cues of their production environments before they begin working in them, they are engaging in what is as much an act of persuasion as any we've treated in this book. The only difference is that they've chosen themselves rather than others as their targets. During the rest of her phone report, I recognized that the manager and her team were treating the undertaking as a learning process, perfecting the tactic as they go. They believe they've found that action shots of employees at work produce better results for the program design team than simple headshots. Even more impressive is the clever way in which they've taken a piece of psychological information, that background cues in one's physical environment can guide how one thinks there, and employed it to generate a desired effect. Most impressively, they haven't allowed themselves to be disadvantaged by an existing reality that relegates them to task environments with suboptimal cues and associations. Instead, they've changed that reality by infusing their task environments with more helpful varieties that automatically activate a preferred way of responding. We can do the same. Why not? The rewards stand to be great, and there are two attractive options for accomplishing this kind of synchronizing cues with goals. We can follow the lead of the design team and alter key components of our external self-persuasive geography. Or we can alter key components of our internal self-persuasive geography. We've already covered the former, so let's turn to the latter. What's already in us? It's easy for some feature of the outside world to redirect our attention to an inner feature, to a particular attitude, belief, trait, memory, or sensation. As I've reported, there are certain consequential effects of such a shift in focus. Within that moment, we are more likely to grant the focal factor importance, assign it causal status, and undertake action associated with it. Have you ever attended an arts performance disturbed by another audience member's loud coughs? In addition to the distracting noise, there's another reason that performers of all sorts, stage actors, singers, musicians, dancers, hate the sound of even one cough. It can become contagious. Although there is solid scientific proof of this point, the most dramatic testament comes from the ranks of the artists. The author and playwright Robert Ardrey described how the offensive sequence operates in a theater. One cougher begins his horrid work in an audience, and the cough spreads until the house is in bedlam, the actors in a rage, and the playwright in retreat to the nearest saloon. This kind of contagion isn't confined to gatherings of playgoers. In one case, 200 attendees at a newspaper editorial writer's dinner were overcome by coughing fits after the problem began in one corner of the room and spread so pervasively that officials had to evacuate everyone, including the Attorney General of the United States at the time, Janet Reno. Despite rigorous testing of the room, no physical cause for the coughing spasms could be found. Every year, thousands of similar incidents involving sundry symptoms besides coughing take place around the world. Consider a few representative examples. In Austria, the news media reported several sightings of a poisonous variety of spider, whose bite produced a combination of headache and nausea. Residents flooded hospitals certain that they had been bitten. Those who were wrong outnumbered those who were right by 4,000%. When a Tennessee high school teacher reported that she smelled gas in her classroom and felt dizzy and nauseous, an array of individuals, including students, other teachers, and staff, started experiencing the same symptoms. 100 people from the school went to hospital emergency rooms that day with symptoms associated with the gas leak,
as did 71 more when the school reopened 5 days later. No gas leak was found on either day or ever. Citizens of two small Canadian towns located near oil refineries learned from an epidemiological study that cancer rates in their communities were 25% higher than normal, which led residents to begin perceiving escalations in a variety of health problems associated with exposure to toxic chemicals. However, the validity of these perceptions was undercut when the study's authors issued a retraction months later. The elevated incidence of cancer in the communities had initially been reported in error due to a statistical miscalculation. In Germany, audience members listening to a lecture on dermatological conditions, typically associated with itchy skin, immediately felt skin irritations of their own and began scratching themselves at an increased rate. This last example offers the best indication of what's going on, as it seems akin to the well-known occurrence of medical student syndrome. Research shows that 70% to 80% of all medical students are afflicted by this disorder, in which they experience the symptoms of whatever disease they happen to be learning about at the time and become convinced that they have contracted it. Warnings by their professors to anticipate the phenomenon don't seem to make a difference. Students nonetheless perceive their symptoms as alarmingly real, even when experienced serially with each new disease of the week. An explanation that has long been known to medical professionals tells us why. As the physician George Lincoln Walton wrote in 1908, "Medical instructors are continually consulted by students who fear that they have the diseases they are studying. The knowledge that pneumonia produces pain in a certain spot leads to a concentration of attention upon that region, which causes any sensation there to give alarm. The mere knowledge of the location of the appendix transforms the most harmless sensations in that region into symptoms of serious menace." What are the implications for achieving effective influence, in this case, effective self-influence? Lying in low-level weight within each of us are units of experience that can be given sudden standing and force if we just divert our attention to them. There are the constituents of a cough in all of us, and we can activate them by concentrating on the upper half of the lungs, where coughs start. Try it. You'll see. The same applies to the constituents of dizziness, nausea, or headache, which we can activate by focusing on a spot in the middle of the brain or at the top of the stomach or just above the eyes, respectively. But those units of experience waiting within us also include advantageous attitudes, productive traits, and useful capacities that we can energize by merely channeling attention to them instead. Let's explore how that might work for our most coveted unit of experience, felt happiness. Although cherished for its own sake, happiness provides an additional benefit. It doesn't just flow from favorable life circumstances, it also creates them, including higher levels of physical health, psychological well-being, and even general success. There's good justification, then, for determining how to increase our joyfulness through self-influence. But to do so, first we have to unravel a mystery from the arena of happiness studies. The positivity paradox. Suppose that following an extensive physical checkup, your doctor returned to the examination room conveying undeniable news of a medical condition that will impair your health in multiple ways. Its relentless advance will erode your ability to see, hear, and think clearly. Your enjoyment of food will be undercut by the combination of a dulled sense of taste and a compromised digestive system that will limit your dietary choices to mostly bland options. You'll lose access to many of your favorite activities as the condition saps your energy and strength.
eventually making you unable to drive or even to walk on your own. You'll become increasingly vulnerable to an array of other afflictions, such as coronary heart disease, stroke, atherosclerosis, pneumonia, arthritis, and diabetes. You don't have to be a health professional to identify this progressive medical condition. It's the process of growing old. The undesirable outcomes of aging vary from person to person, but on average, elderly individuals experience significant losses in both physical and mental functioning. Yet they don't let the declines undermine their happiness. In fact, and here's the paradox, old age produces the opposite result. The elderly feel happier than they did when younger, stronger, and healthier. The question of why this paradox exists has intrigued camps of lifespan researchers for decades. After considering several possibilities, one set of investigators, led by the psychologist Laura Carstensen, hit upon a surprising answer. When it comes to dealing with all the negativity in their lives, seniors have decided that they just don't have time for it, literally. They've come to desire a time of emotional contentment for their remaining years, and they take deliberate steps to achieve it, something they accomplish by mastering the geography of self-influence. The elderly go more frequently and fully to the locations inside and outside themselves populated by mood-lifting personal experiences. To a greater extent than younger individuals, seniors recall positive memories, entertain pleasant thoughts, seek out and retain favorable information, search for and gaze at happy faces, and focus on the upsides of their consumer products. Notice that they route their travels to these sunny locales through a highly effective mental maneuver we've encountered before. They focus their attentions on those spots. Indeed, the seniors with the best attention management skills, those good at orienting to and staying fixed on positive material, show the greatest mood enhancement. Those with poor such skills, however, can't use strong attentional control to extricate themselves from their tribulations. They are the ones who experience mood degeneration as they age. I'd bet they are also the ones who account for the misguided stereotype of the elderly as irascible and sour, because the grumpy are just more conspicuous than the contented. I once asked Professor Carstensen how she first got the idea that many elderly have decided to make the most of their remaining days by concentrating on the positive over the negative. She reported having interviewed a pair of sisters living in a senior home and asking them how they dealt with various negative events. For example, the sickness and death they witnessed regularly all around them. They replied in unison, "Oh, we don't have time for worrying about that." She recalled being puzzled by the answer because, as retirees with no jobs, housekeeping tasks, or family responsibilities, they had nothing but time in their days. Then, with an insight that launched her influential thinking on the topic of lifespan motivation, Carstensen recognized that the time the sisters referred to wasn't the amount available to them in any one day, but in the rest of their lives. From that perspective, allocating much of their remaining time to unpleasant events didn't make sense to the ladies. What about the rest of us, though? Must we wait for advanced age to bring about a happy outlook on life? According to research in the field of positive psychology, no. But we do have to alter our tactics to be more like seniors. Luckily for us, someone has already prepared a list of ways to go about it persuasively. Dr. Sonia Lubomirsky is not the first researcher to study happiness. Yet in my view, she has made noteworthy contributions to the subject by choosing to investigate a key question more systematically than anyone else. It's not the conceptual one you might think. What are the factors associated with happiness? Instead, it's a procedural one. which specific activities can we perform to increase our happiness? As a child, Lubomirsky came to the United States as part of a family of Russian immigrants who, in the midst of meager economic circumstances, had to deal with the relentless additional problems of fitting into an unfamiliar and sometimes challenging culture. At the same time, this new life brought many favorable and gratifying features. Looking back on those days, she wondered what actions family members could have taken to disempower the dispiriting emotions in favor of the uplifting ones. It wasn't all bleak, she wrote in her 2013 book, The Myths of Happiness. But if I knew then what I know now, my family would have been better positioned to make the best of it. That statement made me curious to know what she does know now on the matter. I phoned and asked what she could say with scientific confidence about the steps people can take to make their lives better, emotionally. Her answer offered good news and bad news to anyone interested in securing a gladness upgrade. On the one hand, she specified a set of manageable activities that reliably increase personal happiness. Several of them, including the top three on her list, required nothing more than a persuasive refocusing of attention. 1. Count your blessings and gratitudes at the start of every day, and then give yourself concentrated time with them by writing them down. 2. Cultivate optimism by choosing beforehand to look on the bright side of situations, events, and future possibilities. 3. Negate the negative by deliberately limiting time spent dwelling on problems or on unhealthy comparisons with others. There's even an iPhone app called Live Happy that helps users engage in certain of these activities, and their greater happiness correlates with frequent use. On the other hand, the process requires consistent work. You can make yourself happier just like you can make yourself lose weight, Dr. Lubomirsky assured me. But like eating differently and going to the gym faithfully, you have to put in the effort every day. You have to stay with it. That last comment seemed instructive about how the elderly have found happiness. They don't treat the most hospitable places of their inner geographies the way visitors or sightseers would. Instead, they've elected to stay in those vicinities mentally. They've relocated to them psychologically for the same reason they might move physically to Florida or Arizona for the warming climates they encounter every morning. When I asked Dr. Lubomirsky why, before attaining senior status, most people have to work so hard at becoming happier, she said her team hadn't uncovered that answer yet. But I think it might be revealed already in the research of Professor Carstensen, who, you'll recall, found that the elderly have decided to prioritize emotional contentment as a main life goal, and, therefore, to turn their attention systematically toward the positive. They also found that younger individuals have different primary life goals that include learning, developing, and striving for achievement. Accomplishing those objectives requires a special openness to discomforting elements, demanding tasks, contrary points of view, unfamiliar people, and owning mistakes or failures. Any other approach would be maladaptive. It makes sense, then, that in early and middle age, it can be so hard to turn our minds away from tribulations. To serve our principal aims at those times, we need to be receptive to the real presence of negatives in order to learn from and deal with them. The problem arises when we allow ourselves to become mired in the emotions they generate, when we let them lock us into an ever-cycling loop of negativity. There's where Dr. Lubomirsky's activities list can be so helpful. Even if we're not ready to take up full-time residence in our most balmy psychological sites, we can use those attention-shifting activities to visit regularly and break the sieges of winter. The field of happiness studies has shown us that relatively simple attention-based tactics can help manage our emotions.